or the European schools of psychology, in the modern school as they are called, not European, but modern school. Because even in India, those schools are now being taken up by people. And today I want to pursue the subject of taking up the field of psychological research as it has been developed in India and other countries, particularly India. So yesterday I referred to the possibility of the Indian background being referred to as a base for some of our conclusions. Psychology in India, as elsewhere in ancient time, was not a separate science. It was connected with life. And the life in those days was centered around religion. Religion, philosophy, and so psychology also was intimately connected with religion and philosophy. But it did not mean that psychology so evolved was unscientific. People think that when something is connected with religion and philosophy, then either it is superstitious or it is merely intellectual abstraction. Well, this was not necessarily the case with psychology as it was developed in the Eastern countries. For if generalization based on practical experience and experiment is a criterion of a science, then the psychological systems current in India can be called and should be called scientific. Indian psychology bases itself on consciousness as the fundamental fact of the cosmos and of life. To it, matter is the fact, but one who cognizes the matter is a greater fact than the fact of matter. You see, consciousness is the fundamental fact on which the whole of the cosmos is based. Now, if you go to the books in which you find psychological material, it will require special studies, and therefore I don't want to get into detail. I myself have made a very detailed study of these books with which I am now trying to take you along, because I want to give only summary of the conclusions and some of the, you know, suggestions only by way of showing that there is a sufficient material. The Rig Veda is the oldest book of humanity, and it is the fountainhead of Indian culture. Already it contains enough psychological material to warrant a separate treatment. It is a very vast field. A rough outline can be attempted only. Rig Veda speaks of knowledge, it speaks of consciousness, it speaks of unconsciousness, it speaks of will, thought, it speaks of understanding, it speaks of truths, it speaks of the right. But it expresses its vision in symbolic language, which is a puzzle to the modern mind. The terms which are used in the Rig Veda indicate that the Vedic age was far from being primitive. Some of the terms connected with psychology which the Veda uses are Dhi, meaning understanding or intelligence, Manas, the mind, Buddhi, the intellect, Chetana, consciousness, Ritam, truth, Satyam, truth. Now they make a distinction between Ritam and Satyam. I think in one of my speeches here I dwelt upon it one day. Satyam is from the root us to be, means Sat is a present participle, meaning being. And Sat, when the termination ya is added, becomes a potential noun. Satya means, well, beingness, quality of being, quality of existence, so to say, truth of existence. Ritam comes from the word ritumu. So, the truth of movement, truth of action, truth which becomes right, you see? Well, that is rhythm, movement. They express this shade of difference in the Veda. Satyam and rhythm are two words used in the Rig Veda. So, the word for one who knows the truths wears various. Kavi, the seer. Manishi, the thinker, so to say. One who is the master of thought. Well, Vipra, illumined in consciousness. Medhavi, one full of genius, one who can hold, you know, great truth in his mind. Vipaschit, one whose mind was enlightened, consciousness was enlightened. Daksha, one who has the sight. Well, chitti, consciousness. Mati, well, mentality. Achitti, unconsciousness. Now, these are the words which I quote from the Rig Veda, which shows clearly that they could not have been primitive when they had, this is not a complete list, by the way. This is only some of the words which I have just taken out to show that there is sufficient terminology of psychological, you know, functions in the Rig Veda to warrant us to believe that they knew much more than what is supposed to be known by primitive people or primitive races. They speak also of the various planes of consciousness in terms of symbols. They don't speak of the planes of consciousness in terms of intellect or mind, you see. As modern mind would speak, they speak in terms of symbol. And the language is such a closed and sealed book to the modern mind, and therefore one misses the truth. It mentions the three, you see, it speaks of Dyava Prithivi, for instance. Dyava Prithivi means earth and heaven. Here, the symbol is the physical and the mental planes of consciousness. Earth is the physical plane, well, heaven is the mental plane. It also mentions Antariksha, the intermediate plane, means the vital plane between earth and heaven, physical and the mental. It even speaks of the triple shining realms of the mind, called in the Rig Veda Trini Rochana, triple shining realms of mind. Surya, the sun, is a symbol of illumination of knowledge, of truth consciousness. When it speaks of the sun, it wants to speak about the truth consciousness, the illuminating power of knowledge. Well, the Vedics just spoke of the ascent of the human soul from plane to plane, from darkness to light. I'll quote only one hymn to quote to you that they actually did speak of the transition or ascent from darkness to light. It is the first mandal, 50th sukta and 10th hymn of the Rig Veda. It says, Udvayan tamasaspari jyotish pasyanta uttaran devan devatra suryam aganmat jyotiruttamam. Beholding a higher light beyond this darkness, we followed it and reached the highest light of all, the supreme sun. Now here, the reference to darkness and the Rishi rising gradually from the realm of darkness to the realm of light is a clear indication of what they meant by ascent to the sun and also bringing down of the sun to the earth. They speak of double movement, of the movement of the human soul rising to the sun and trying to bring down the sun on the earth. Well, they also, there is also a mention of the all-pervading principle or deity called Vishnu. Vishnu, the all-pervading Godhead. In the first mandal, and I think it is 156th sutta, 156th, I think, hymn, it speaks of triple-fold steps of the universal movement of Vishnu. The text is like that. Trini pada vichakrame Vishnu gopa adabhya. Three steps he took, the all-pervading deity, irrepressible, the protector of the people. And he took these three steps. Now, Vishnu is the wide-moving one. Vishnu to pervade, to be wide, to be imminent. He is that which has gone abroad in the language of the Isha Upanishad. We read it on the first day, if you remember. Sapariyagat. He went abroad, triply extending himself in the superconscient realm of bliss, in the heaven of mind, and in the earth. And ato dharmani dharayan, and pervading the supraconscient, the mental and the physical world, he maintains them by supporting the functions of each according to its constitution. The earth is made to support the earth constitution, the mind is made to support the mental constitution, the supramental acts in its light of the truth. Now, this gives you some idea that the symbolism of the Rig Veda speaks of an amount of knowledge, psychological, you know, store of knowledge, which was there, but now it is so, well, housed in a language or couched in a language of symbols, that for the modern mind it becomes a very difficult problem to get at the what it meant. It was a sort of a happy accident that Sri Aurobindo, in his actual yogic practice, we shall deal with it when we come to the Veda, he actually came across certain experience which opened out the meaning and significance of the symbol to him in his yogic life. And it is because of that knowledge that he went back to the Vedas, well, studied the Veda, and brought out a new interpretation of the Rig Veda. And the modern mind is so much obsessed with what they are doing, you know, that they wouldn't look at it because they have written a cupboard full of books. And now they can't throw it in the waste paper basket, you see. They can't think of it as if they were. Yes, certainly, it has some meaning. It has some meaning of the outer shell, the grammar, the prosody, the language. That is all right. That's in its proper place. I mean, that is a contribution. But to say that they know what the Veda mean, well, it is to say that they don't know what they are talking about. In fact, all the Western Indologists who are claiming to be students of Veda have not even got to the beginning of knowing it. Because unless you get at the meaning of the symbol, you can never understand it. It is just like you take a watch. Now you take a watch to an African who has never seen a watch. Now, if you take it to him and ask him to hear, he will say, oh, it is some devil is inside. Devil is inside first. Well, if you open it out and show that there is a machine, a mechanism, and he can arrange it and it will again work, then he would say, yes, it's a mechanism, where a mechanism works and something goes round. That's all about that he can understand. He won't be able to understand that this measures time, that it's a symbol, that this measures time. He will take, you know, a lot of understanding to come to that. Because for him, first of all, this movement itself is something, you know, which he doesn't know. And if you explain the mechanism, he understands it is mechanical. But that this is a symbol of a movement of the whole, you know, solar system, well, he would not understand. Just the same as happened to these Indologists with regard to Veda. They took it up and said, oh, sociology, let us understand society. Oh, what was that marriage system? What was the inheritance? What is that? Rig Veda was not written to convey to idea of society, idea of inheritance, idea of how they ate and how they slept. It was not written. And if you haven't got that, how are you going to get at the meaning? You see, the whole difficulty is that, you know, oh, this means something. Then you know that now it is explained to you. You understand it like that afterwards, you see. So that is what has happened to the Rig Veda. Now I'll read you one or two more hymns to show. In the language of the Rig Veda itself, not at all adding anything by way of interpretation, literal translation, and you will see what it means. Fourth mandal, second hymn, second sukta, 12th hymn. Chittim achittim chinavad vividvan. Now, chitti is a word used in the Vedantic terminology, also means consciousness. So the wise or the knower must distinguish between consciousness and unconsciousness. You see, it speaks of chitti, achitti, consciousness, unconsciousness. Another verse of the fifth mandal, 19th sukta, first hymn. It says, abhyavastha prajayante pavavre vavri adathe. It says, states after states are born. Covering after covering opens to consciousness. In the lap of the mother, he wholly sees. Now this expression of avastha, avastha means consciousness. This is also classical Sanskrit. So state after state is born. Condition after condition of consciousness reveals itself. Well, the Rig Veda fifth mandala speaks of it already. In the fifth mandal, 62nd sukta, first hymn, you find ritena ritam apihitam. A truth is covered by another truth. Now they knew the gradation of the truths, where a lesser truth was covered by the higher truth. As the Veda is creation of an age which was not predominantly intellectual, it is difficult to convey to the modern mind the rich contribution of Rigveda to the field of psychology. Now we come next to the Upanishads. The Upanishads, like the Veda, are not intellectual in their method also. The Upanishads do not speak of their experience in terms of mind, in terms of intellect. They speak of spiritual experience in language of intuition, in the language of inspiration and revelation. And they indicate the solution of fundamental problems through their expressions. We may say that the Dionysian and Eleusinian and Orphic mysteries of the West corresponded to something like what the Upanishads did or stand for. The Upanishad speaks of various states of human consciousness. Upanishad also speaks of it in terms of mind. Now you can understand it. They speak in terms of, you know, what people could understand. It speaks of the Jagrat, the waking consciousness. It speaks of Swapna, the dream state. It speaks of Sushupti, the deep sleep state. It speaks of Turiya, the state beyond the three, the fourth state as they would call it. It speaks also of the various levels of consciousness. It speaks of the Annamaya, the material. It speaks of the Pranamaya, the vital. It speaks of the Manomaya, the mental or intellectual. It speaks of the Vijnanamaya, the supramental. It speaks of the Anandamaya, the delight level of consciousness, or the delight plane of being. Well, the cosmic planes manifest themselves also in the human being according to the Upanishads. And they are experienced by men as various sheets of being, koshas, sheets. One shat, sheet, just as you take an onion and you remove one cover, then you draw another cover, third cover, fourth cover. Each one is called a sheet. You understand? So the human being is physical sheets, vital sheet, the mental sheet, and so on. They speak of several sheets of the human being. Various sheets in the ascending order from the inconscient to the superconscient. Man has got his physical, which is called the Annamaya. Man has got the vital, which is called the Pranamaya. Man has got the mental sheet, the Manomaya. Man has got the Vijnanamaya. Man has got the Anandamaya, the superconscient and the delight plane. Two highest not yet manifested. Up to the mind, the kosha is conscious. Physical being is conscious. Vital being is conscious. Mental being is conscious. In the three koshas, the three covers, or three sheets, man is conscious. The other two are potential and capable of being manifested or experienced, well, by human conscious effort. That is what yoga stands for, you see. Now, they speak of the plane of truth as full of golden light. They speak also of the Supreme whose omnipotence rules the world. They do not speak of it only as a state of consciousness. They speak of it as Saha, He, not it. You see, Isha Upanishad begins with Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. All this is for habitation by the Lord. It does not say by it. You see, there are passages in which the Supreme Infinite Consciousness is spoken of as it, as impersonal, or, you know, without any reference to personality. But there are plenty of passages in which it is spoken of as a personality, as a He. And here, the governance of the world, the Supreme Omnipotence, rules the world. Well, it is said to be Vyad Asi Agnistapati. The fire burns because of the fear of Him, fear of the Omnipotent Divine. It is the fiat of the Supreme that has gone forth, and the fire has got to burn. You see, Bhayadasya Agnistapati. The fire burns because of the fear of Him, because of His order, because of His command, because He has to obey. Well, this dynamic aspect of the Supreme also is spoken of in the Upanishad. And there is an insistence thus in the dynamic aspect of the reality. And the ring of concrete experience also accompanies many of the inspired utterances of the Upanishad. Upanishads are not merely intellectual, philosophical statements, you see. For instance, one of the verses says, Vedahametam Purusham Mahantam Aditya Varanam Tamasakvarastat. One of the seers says, I have known, Veda Aham, I have known. You see, the great Purusha, the great being, the great self, golden of light, solar in color, Aditya Varnam means full of solar light, whose light shines from beyond darkness, tamasa parastat, from beyond the realm of darkness. Now here you find somebody speaking, anybody can say, but you, when you read it in context, you feel that it is a language of experience. You do not think it's an intellectual statement or it's a wishful thinking. When you read in the context, you, when you come across the sentence, you don't think, oh, it is wishful thinking. No, you feel the ring of concrete experience in the very utterance of a seer who bursts out. For instance, in another context, he says, aham annam, aham annam, aham annadaha. I am matter. Anna means food. But food is a symbol of matter because you live on matter, you see. So, anna is a symbol of matter. Aham annam, aham annam, aham annadaha. I am matter. I am matter. I am one with the inconscient. And then last he says, aham annadaha. I am one who enjoys or takes the delight of matter. Now there you see the identification of the objective and the subjective and the unity of all and yet a multiple manifestation of the one. All that is compact in that expression. I am matter. I am matter. I am one who enjoys or takes the delight of matter. You see, this is only one small. Aham annam, aham annam, aham annadaha. Or it says, Suvarna jyoti abhyabhavam. I have become that golden light. Suvarna is gold, you see. Suvarna jyoti, golden light. I have become that golden light. Now this expression, and then amrutasya nabhayi. I have attained, you know, the level of immortality. The expression as they come, you find that it is not speculations, as you say, but well, states which show that they had process of experience which, well, made them go through some concrete experience which found expression in these inspired utterances which people preserved. You do not know who spoke these words. Their names are not known. People preserved it simply because they thought this was very important and very precious, you know, possession of humanity. Now, it is, there is nothing in it. You can't make, you know, 1 cent out of it if you go to the market. You can't sell it. It has nothing to do with what is. And yet, it has so much to do with what man can become that man didn't allow it to be lost. You see, for instance, they believed that in the possibility, divine potentiality of the human being. And so when one seer addresses the people that are gathered, he says, Shrunvantu Vishve Amrutasya Putraha. O ye children of immortality, O ye all children of immortality, listen to me. Now he knew very well that he was addressing mortal man. I mean, he was not so blind as to know that human. But he didn't address them as, you know, oh, mortal creatures, listen to what I say. No, he said, listen to me, O children of immortality. Now, that shows that they had a belief and a faith in the potentiality of the divinity of man and the capacity of man to reach and to realize his fundamental and essential divinity. Now, there you see, this idea of reaching the immortal truths or truths which is the same as immortality, because truth is immortal, truth is eternal, you see. And when you read the truth, you read the eternal and the immortal. That was the inspiration and that was the aspiration which also they got. And as against this great ideal of realizing the truth, realizing the immortal, realizing the essential delight of existence, the ananda as they call it, the delight, which is the creative principle of the cosmos, which is the one, which is infinite, which is delight, immortal and the truth. They believed that that was, well, the highest fulfillment of human existence on earth. That man's fulfillment on earth consisted in is reaching this status of consciousness, which is potential to him, a status of truth, status of light, status of immortality, status of eternal, essential, infinite delight. Well, this is their purpose. And as against that, even in the Upanishad, you find Yajnavalkya, one of the seers, is leaving his house to practice yoga. And he divides his property between his two wives. So one of the wives turned round and said, well, what is it that you are going for? He said, I am going for realizing the infinite in the truth. And they said, then what shall I do with this wealth which you have given to me? He said, by that you will be able to live. He said that, what's use of mere wealth which does not lead me to the immortal? Now there they had a value of life, you see. The values in life are ultimately the things that matter. Not what is, but what you believe it to be. She divided his property, which was quite considerable perhaps, and he gave a portion to her. She said she was not satisfied with the property that was given. She wanted to know that for which he was leaving all his property. You understand? So that is how the Upanishad established values of life in Indian culture. And these psychological, you know, truths which we have seen are, well, it is an outline. You can't give a complete, you know, study, which means a book on Upanishadic psychology you have to write, you see. Then you come to Buddhism. Because after the way the Upanishadic, you come to Buddhism. That is just the next cultural, you know, efflorescence in India. He developed a psychological system of self-discipline whose aim was to free man from suffering. That was the problem of Buddha. How to free man from suffering. And it lacks the positive aim of the Upanishad and the Vedanta. The approach of Buddhist might be said to be a pragmatic approach, as it hardly tries to tackle the fundamental problem of philosophy. Buddha was not in that sense strictly a philosopher. He was one who was, you know, concerned with the problem of pain and wanted to give to the world a solution of that problem. It comes nearest to the present empirical schools of psychology and is almost existential in its metaphysical stand, Buddhism, you see. Abandonment of Trishna, the impulse to possess, the impulse to have, the acquisitive tendency. Well, that is his one great principle which he wants to give in psychology. That is the remedy for banishing suffering. It leads gradually to the state of nirvana, which is described in negative terms. On the metaphysical side, the stress is on the doctrine of karma, that you act and what you act reacts upon you. You get all the reactions of your actions. And to be released from action, well, you must release yourself from the very movement of action. There is not any substratum of individual being in Buddhism. And because according to Buddhism, the individual being is only a flux, a constant flow of consciousness, a stream, you see. And therefore, the persistence of individuality is only a temporary experience. It is nothing permanent. Now, karma explains, according to Buddhism, the tendencies, aptitudes and capacities of the individual which you find in life. How are different individuals so much differentiated from each other? You would say because of karma, because of your past action. Rejection of desire and a gradual exercise of eightfold path would prepare the individual, according to Buddhism, for nirvana. A state in which the ego and perhaps also the entire being passes or ceases. Egoless state, according to some school of Buddhism, can lead the individual to universal compassion and a dynamic flow of help and sympathy, which would bring ultimate release of nirvana to all. Thus eliminate suffering from the world. That is one school. This is not the belief of all the schools of Buddhism. Please note. Now, then you come to the fourth synthesis of Indian culture, the Gita. You see, in the Gita you find first the triple status of the ultimate reality. Triple status meaning transcendental, universal and the individual. One ultimate divine omnipresent reality, according to Gita, takes three positions, the Purushottama, the Vishwarupa, and the individual Vyakti. Kshara, Akshara, Vishwarupa, Purushottama, they will say. Kshara is the mutable individual personality. Akshara is the immutable, the Vishwarupa is the cosmic dynamis or dynamic cosmic consciousness, and the Uttama is the transcendent divine consciousness which uses or manifests itself in the cosmic and the individual. The transcendent, the supreme consciousness, uses the cosmic and the individual as terms of its manifestation. So the triple status or identity of the three is affirmed in the Gita. The Uttama, the highest or transcendent reality, cosmic or universal reality, individual, the reality of the individual person. Well, all the three are identical. This is Gita's one stand. Now, thus it speaks about the individual and collective consciousness in terms of the transcendent and advocates the transformation of the individual by elimination of the elements of ignorance from his nature. Gita utilizes the great psychological discovery of the Sankhya. Sankhya is a very prominent school of Indian philosophy in which, for the first time, a very powerful analytical process was successfully carried out by Indian metaphysicians, and it comes very near to the scientific system of the West. Well, it first makes the division of consciousness into Purusha, the witness self, and nature, the dynamic flow of nature, dynamic movement of nature. The Purusha is the Sakshi, the witness. There is in each individual a subjective element which can separate itself from the movement of nature. In the mind of man, it is quite possible for the mental being to separate watching, observing, witnessing self and what passes before it as the flow of nature. For instance, one can separate the Purusha, the subjective witness in the mind, and see the mental thoughts in the mind passing as if they were somebody else's thoughts. This is a process of Sankhya which has a great application in the yogic life also, because that gives to the consciousness of the subjective self, the individual, a free ground on which it can stand. Otherwise, you are in the flow of nature. All the time you are identified with nature, and when you sit down for meditation, people always complain, "Oh, I sat down for half an hour, but my mind was not quiet." Well, because you constantly identified yourself with the mind. If you had separated yourself from the mind and stood apart in mind, watching your thought, then you would have seen the thought as if they were outside you. That you are like one who is standing on the river or on the flow of the current. Now the current is flowing all the time. Now if you allow yourself to flow with the current and then you try to meditate in the current, then you are all the time running with the current. And so you say, "Oh, I want to stand. But all the time the current is taking you. But if you get up on the shore and then see, "Oh, this is the current that is flowing. Oh, this is how current of thought or suggestions, ideas or impulses are running or flowing in my mind." Then you get self-knowledge. Self-knowledge begins with the knowledge of nature. You see, the self-knowledge doesn't begin with the knowledge of the self directly, no. The first self that you really know, means know by identification, know by experience, is your witness self. He is the one who is independent, observer, witness. The seer, the element in the mind or in life or in the emotional being that separates and sees, "Oh, this is how my mind is working." Well, that is the first ground of freedom. You have got somewhere you stand steady without being moved by nature. The first step to establish mastery over nature is to stand apart. It's an easier method of controlling nature also. Because once you stand apart, you will be able to put a will which will be able ultimately to control and guide the thought, guide the current of movement that is going on, either thoughts or ideas or impulses or desires or ambitions or greed or selfishness or ego, whatever is coming, you will be able to see. And one great advantage is that when you see the movement of nature, it has no power to control you. It is like somebody, you are here and you have seen that there is a thief. Well, the thief knows that you have seen him, then he won't be easily able to come and steal. He knows that, oh, he is watched. The moment he knows that you know, well, half of his strength is gone. The same with regard to nature. When you know that, oh, I have some difficulty in my vital being, I have some true turning to light in my mind, but in my vital, I am turned towards selfishness or attachment or desire or possession and so on. Well, that means the power of that impulse is reduced. To know is not bad. It is good to know oneself as he is. It is no use trying to believe and be self-complacent and say, I'm very wonderful and marvelous and perfect. That is just the wrong thing in yoga. In yoga, you are forced to make discovery that man is ignorant, that one is a fool or one is a rogue. Or, you know, one has many, many stupidities in himself. Well, that is a good discovery. It's nothing wrong about it. So, when you see, then you half the strength of the impulse, the idea or the suggestion is gone. It has lost 50% of its power. Because it also knows, don't think that these are unconscious movements. You see, if you have a serious idea of yoga, you must know from in advance that there is no unconscious movement in nature. Whole is conscious. The whole universe is living. It is a conscious universe in which you live. It is pulsating with life. It is all the time vibrating with consciousness. If you see a stock and stone and a mountain and you see it is not moving, it is wrong. It is all the time living, you see. And therefore, ideas or thoughts, they have consciousness behind it. They have entities behind it. They have elemental powers behind it. And they know that you have seen. Remember, they will know at once that you have seen. And when they know that you have seen, well, then much of their power is already gone. They lose their capacity to hold you in their clutch, you see. Well, that is one important discovery to make. Now, what I was telling, it was about the Sakshi, is it not? We are talking about the witness self. Yes, now this witness self is the first step. This witness, according to Gita, is the Anumanta, one who gives the consent. He is the Bharta, the supporter of nature. He is the Bhokta, the enjoyer of nature. He is Ishvara, the Lord of nature. Well, beginning with the witness self, when you exercise your separation, you become the one who gives the consent, one who gives the support, one who enjoys, and one who rules. Ultimately, end by ruling nature. Well, these steps, Gita, actually, I have quoted you the words of the Gita almost, you see. Now, it also tries successfully to systematize and synthesize the effort of the three psychological powers of man, the intellect, the emotion, and the will, the Jnana Yoga, the Karma Yoga, and the Bhakti Yoga. Gita makes a synthesis of all the three efforts of human consciousness to rise to the Supreme. And by purifying the nature, by concentration and by development, and it ends by enlarging the scope from finite to the infinite. The mind, the emotion, and the will are developed gradually, step by step, to move from finite to the infinite. Thus, psychology in India is not, as it is in Europe, a child of scientific age. Indian approach all along has been to regard psychology rather as a science of discipline of life, mainly concerned with developing human consciousness. They did not want to study mentally and arrive at some conclusions. They wanted to make it a culture, self-development, you see, and arrive at certain development of consciousness. Pursuit of this psychology has been the most persistent and leading note of Indian culture throughout Indian history. As Dr. Indrasen puts it, Indian psychology does not merely ask, what am I? But also asks, what can I become and how? Not what I am. That is what most of the schools are doing. And what I am may be very stupid, but what you can become might be something wonderful. Introspection and widening and heightening of consciousness are the methods which are employed in Indian psychology. Now, Sri Aurobindo's contribution to psychology is so vast and varied that it easily yields enough material for a book on New Indian Approach to Psychology of Man. That would be the title of a book to be written by somebody. I don't know who will do that. It's a big work. Here I shall attempt only to put down his own words, what he means by consciousness, by the subconscious, and by the vital being, so that you know some of the major, you know, faculties of man with which he deals. Consciousness, one term. Subconscious, two. Third is vital being. Now, when you come across in his writing on yoga, 2-3 volumes like that, these terms, you get baffled and say, but what does he mean by consciousness? What does he mean by subconscious? What does he mean by vital being? I won't take all these words which he uses. We'll take 2 or 3 so as to give us, because you see, to go through would require 1 or 2 years. You see, if you want to go through everything, it means 1 year, 8 months, or 9 months, or 10 months. Well, that being not possible, we'll try to make an outline. The student of psychology will have enough material in these quotations to stimulate his mind and lead him to more detailed study of the subject. That is one. Now, general observations by Sri Aurobindo himself, because certain letters were written to him and he had occasion to write and speak about these modern schools of psychology, and some questions were referred to him. So I give you his observation so that you may know how, apart from my, you know, survey of modern school of psychology yesterday, how he looks at it and how our standpoint is one, because mine is derived from his standpoint, naturally. The current conceptions and methods employed in modern psychology have been subjected to some observation by Sri Aurobindo on certain occasions. Saint Augustine was a man of God and a great saint. But great saints are not always or often great psychologists or great thinkers. Somebody quoted a passage from Saint Augustine and said that, what do you think about this passage? So Sri Aurobindo is replying. The psychology here is that of the most superficial schools. I mean, psychology which is contained in Saint Augustine's quotation, you see, of not that of a man in the street. I am aware that these errors are practically universal. For psychological inquiry in Europe, and without inquiry there can be no sound knowledge, is only beginning, and has not yet gone very far. And what has reigned in man's mind up to now is superficial statement of the superficial appearances of our consciousness as they look to us at first view, and nothing more. Well, I am giving you a considered opinion of some great authority. You must know that he wouldn't lightly give an opinion if he knew that what he was talking was something which he really thought to be very true. Well, but knowledge only begins when you get away from surface phenomena and look behind the phenomena for their true operation and causes. To the superficial view, the outer mind and sense, the sun is a little fiery ball circulating and circling in the midair round the earth. And the stars are twinkling little things struck in the sky for our benefit at night. Scientific inquiry shows, comes and knocks down this infantile first view to pieces. The sun is a huge affair, millions of times miles away from our earth, and round which this small earth is circulating. And the stars are huge members of a huge system, indescribably distant, which have nothing apparently to do with the tiny earth and earth creatures. Well, that is the truth, isn't it? So he says that you don't believe in appearances. All science is like that. A contradiction of the sense view of or superficial appearance of things, and an assertion of the truths which are unguessed by the common and the uninstructed reason. The same process has to be followed in psychology. If we are to really to know what our consciousness is, how it is to build and made, and what is the secret of its functioning and the way out of this disorder, then you must go behind appearance. These are some of the common errors that he is pointing out. One, what are the common errors? That mind and spirit are the same thing. I am giving you so that you may understand. It is our business as people who are interested in Sri Aurobindo intimately to know these things. Mind and spirit are the same thing. That is first error. Second, that all consciousness is spoken of as mind, or can be spoken of as mind. all consciousness is not mental. Third, that all consciousness therefore is of is spiritual substance. That body is merely matter, not conscious. Therefore something quite different from spiritual part of our nature. This is from Yoga. Now he takes up the first. The spirit and mind are two different things and should not be confused together. The mind is an instrumental entity or instrumental consciousness whose function is to think and perceive. The spirit is an essential entity or essential consciousness which does not need to think or perceive either in the mental or sensory way, because whatever knowledge it has is direct. It is essential knowledge. It is called Swayam Prakash, self-illumined. Now you get a distinction, isn't it? That's clear. Next, it follows that all consciousness is not necessarily of spiritual make, and it need not be true, and is not true that the thing commanding and the thing commanded are the same. They are not at all different, are of the same substance, and therefore are bound, or at least ought to agree together. Thirdly, it is not even true that it is the mind which is commanding the mind. Saint Augustine said that one part of my mind is commanding the other mind and it is not obeying. He is, feeling a sort of a sense of sin and a sense of guilt in his consciousness that one part is, is turned towards God, and when he commands the other part of his mind, it does not obey. That is the context. You see, the letter I didn't quote because it is too long to take the whole quotation. You see, now here, it is not true that mind is commanding the mind and finds itself disobeyed. Saint Augustine said, I command one part of my mind and the part of my mind doesn't obey. First, there are many parts of the mind, each a force in itself with its formations, functions and interests, and they may not agree. One part of the mind may be spiritually influenced and like to think of the divine and obey spiritual impulse. Another part of the mind may be rational or scientific or literary and prefer to follow formations and belief and doubts, mental preferences and interests, which are in conformity with its education and its nature. It may not want to follow God at all. This happens. But quite apart from that, what was commanding in Saint Augustine may very well have been his thinking mind or reason, while that which was commanded was his vital being. And mind and vital, whatever anybody may say, are not the same. Now here you come to another distinction. We spoke of spirit and mind as separate, is it not? Now he says mind and vital are not the same. We'll come to it, you see. The thinking mind or buddhi lives, however imperfectly in man, by intelligence and by reason, that is mind. Intellectuality, rationality. Vital being, on the other hand, is a thing of desires, impulses, pushes of force, emotions, sensations, seeking after life fulfillment, possession, enjoyment. That is vital being. Do you understand the distinction now? You get it right? Mind and vital? Well, whenever you read any book, at least you are clear about the distinction. These cannot mean the same thing. These are its functions and its nature. It is that part of us which seeks after life, after its movement for their own sake, and it does not want to leave hold of these things if they bring it suffering as well as or more than pleasure. It is even capable of luxuriating in tears. It can enjoy and take delight of tears, this vital part. Suffering is a part of drama of life. That is the vital being. What then is there in common between thinking intelligence and the vital? And why should the latter, means the vital, obey the mind and not follow its own nature? Saint Augustine's complaint was that what his mind was commanding, the other part, he called it mind, but it was really his vital, which was not obeying. And Sri Aurobindo said, well, that is natural. The vital is made to function differently, the mind is made to fulfill it, another function altogether. That is, obedience is perfectly normal instead of being, as Augustine suggests, unintelligible. Of course, man can establish a mental control over his vital, and in so far as he does, he is a man. The vital is full of impulse, desires, ambitions, and pushes of emotions and sensations and so on. Well, the degree to which man establishes mental control over this vital part, well, he is a human being, a man. Because the thinking mind is a nobler and a more entitled entity and consciousness than vital, and ought therefore to rule. And if the mental will is strong, it can rule. But this rule is precarious, incomplete, and held only much by self-discipline. For if the mind is more entitled, the vital is nearer to the earth. The vital is more intense, vital is more vehement. Mind is near life. Life is near earth, and has a greater hold. You see, vehement, more directly able to touch the body. There is too a vital mind which lives by imagination, thoughts of desire, will to act, and enjoy from its own impulse, and this is able to seize on the reason itself and make the reason its auxiliary, its justifying counsel and supplier of pleas and excuses. That is what the vital being does. Vital being approaches the reason, convinces it, goes around it, persuades it, and then the reasoning being or reasoning power is made to support the vital. This is 9 out of 10, that is what happens. You see, when a man justifies his vital impulse, he takes the help of mind as a counsel and says, well, am I not all right? And supposing I don't do this, if I don't smoke, say for instance, shall I not fall ill? It is better that I continue, otherwise my health will suffer. Well, that's just like that. Yes, yeah, the vital comes in and goes round the mind and persuades it and makes it his counsel and will take the full support of the mind, rather than acting out in the light of the mind. Mind is not allowed to operate and exercise its knowledge without hampering. Yes. There is also sheer force of desire in man, which is the vital principle support and strong enough to sweep off man's reason. As the Gita says, like a boat on stormy waters. Vayur navam ibambasi, that is the word in the Gita, you see. Like a boat on a stormy waters, you simply carry it. That's what the vital does. Finally, the body obeys the mind automatically in those things in which it is formed or trained to obey. But the relation of the body to the mind is not in all things that of an automatic and perfect instrument. No. The body obeys the mind when it is trained to obey the mind, not without. You would make a man drill, then he will obey. As soon as the order is given, the body will turn. But if he is not trained well, he takes 2 minutes before he finds out what he has to do. The body also has a consciousness of its own. And though it is a submental instrument or a servant consciousness, it can disobey and fail to obey as well. Well, that is one. That is St. Augustine's psychology. In many things, in matters of health and illness, for instance, in all automatic functioning, the body acts on its own and is not a servant of the mind. If it is fatigued, it can offer a passive resistance to the mind's will. Your mind wants to work, well, the body is tired, well, won't work. It can cloud the mind with tamas, inertia and dullness, fumes of subconscious, so that the mind cannot act. That's what the body does sometimes. The arm lifts, no doubt, when it gets the suggestion. But at the first, the legs don't obey when they are asked to walk. Yes, it can't. Yeah. They have to learn how to leave the crawling attitude and movement and take up erect and ambulatory habit, stand and walk. Even that has to be trained. When you first ask a hand to draw a straight line or play music, well, it can't do it and won't do it. Well, it has to be schooled, it has to be trained. taught, and afterwards it does automatically what it is taught. Automatically, almost it will do, but first you say straight line, no, it will go like that. All this proves that there is a body consciousness which can do things at mind's order, but has to be awakened, has to be trained, and has to be made a good and conscious instrument. It can even be so trained that a mental will or suggestion can cure the illness of the body. You can train, you have to train the body to receive and carry out the suggestion of the mind. But all these things, these relations of mind and body stand on the same footing in a sense as the relation of mind to vital. And it is not so easy or primary a matter as Augustine would have us believe. Well, this put the problem on another footing with the causes and more clear. And if we are prepared to go far enough, it suggests a way out. The way is way of yoga. Now, the mechanical matter, Sirnus writes. In psychology, one can say that the mechanical or physiological approach takes hold of the thing by the blind end and is the least fruitful of all. That is what most of the modern psychologists have been doing. Physiological function. When do you get the impulse? When do you see the light? When did you hear the sound? When did the touch convey to you the impression? What has all that to do with real psychology? It's difficult to believe. But he says, it is catching by the blind end and is the least fruitful of all. For psychology is not primarily a thing of mechanism and measure. That is what they are trying to do, parapsychology and all this measurement of impulses and all sorts of things. It opens to a vast field beyond the physical instrumentalities of the body consciousness. In biology, one can get a glimpse of something beyond mechanism, because there is, from the beginning, a stir of consciousness, progressing and organizing itself more and more for self-expression. But in physics, you are in the very domain of the mechanical law, where process is everything, and the driving consciousness has chosen to conceal itself with the greatest thoroughness, so that scientifically speaking, it does not exist there, consciousness. In the physical, the consciousness has so thoroughly concealed itself that scientifically there is no consciousness. There processes everything, yes. It does not exist. One can discover it there also by occultism and by yoga, but the methods of occult science and yoga are not measurable or followed by or followable by or knowable by means of physical science. So the gulf remains in existence. It may be bridged one day, but the physicist is not likely to be the brick builder. It's not the physicist who will do the job. So it is no use asking him to try what is beyond his province. Now, application of, you know, phenomena of physical phenomena to psychology, he says, to apply the same test to phenomena of a different kind is as foolish as to apply physical test to spiritual truths. One can't dissect God, can't dissect as you put it on the table, or see the soul under a microscope. So also the subjection of disembodied spirits or even a psychophysical phenomena to tests and standard valid only for material phenomena is a most false and unsatisfactory method. Moreover, the physical scientist is far, for the most part, resolved not to admit what cannot be neatly packed, labeled and docketed in his system and its formulae. He's decided. I told you, give the instance of, you know, people in the time of Sir William Crookes in England, you see, the Royal Aesthetic, Royal Scientific Society refused to see a phenomena which he wanted them to see. That she said, I have no explanation, but I want to see because it happens on the plane of matter, plane of you know, physical plane. No, they said, we don't recognize this phenomenon. Dr. Jules Romain, now he gives the instance of a French eminent man, himself a scientist as well as a great writer, makes experiment to prove that man can see and read with eyes blindfolded. The scientists refuse even to admit or even to record the result. This is, I know, Eyeless Sight is a book written by this man, Jules Romain. I read that book, you see. We took it to Sri Aurobindo, and in the evening talk, you will find a mention of this book. In the evening talk, this book is mentioned. Khuda Baksh, he's from Burma. Khuda Baksh comes along and proves it patently, indubitably, under all conditions and tests. The scientists are quite unwilling to cede or record the fact even, though his results are undeniable. He walks on fire unhurt. I mean, he has done it in London, in Paris, in India, in Bombay, in Calcutta, everywhere. It's not a secret as if it were done in a closed room with a medical council sitting. He took all the poisons, I mean, nitric acid, hydrochloric acid, and so on. And survived quite all right. So, he walks on fire, unhurt, and disproves all hitherto suggested explanation. They simply cast about for another and still more silly explanation. Well, what is the use of trying to convince people who are determined not to believe? He is a great sumerist. He has a sense of understanding. No, don't try to convince people who don't want to understand. Psychologists, of course, having to deal with mental movements, more easily recognize that there can be no real equation between them and physiological processes. And at most, mind and body react to each other, as is inevitable, since they are lodging together. But even a great physical scientist like Huxley recognized that mind was something quite different from matter and could not possibly be explained in terms of matter. Only since then, physical science has become very arrogant and bumptious and has tried to subject everything to itself and its processes. Now in theory, at least, it has begun to recognize its limitations in a general way. But the old mentality is still too habitual in most scientists to shake off yet. Now that gives you some observations of Sri Aurobindo on modern psychology. Now, you should take up one more from Sri Aurobindo so that you have a rough outline. The centers of consciousness are seven in number. Seven centers of consciousness in man. 1,000-petal lotus of consciousness on the top of the head, above the head. Just on the crown of the head, you see, like that. In the middle of the forehead, will, vision, and dynamic. Throat center is a center of externalizing mind. The heart lotus, emotional center and seat of the psychic being which is behind it. Navel center is the higher vital proper. Below the navel, the lower vital. And in the end of the spinal cord, Muladhara, the center of the physical. You understand, rough idea you got. One is this 1,000-petal lotus on the crown of the head, above the head, in the middle of the forehead, in the throat, in the heart, in the navel center, below the navel center, and the Muladhara, the end of the spinal cord. These physical centers correspond to psychological centers in the inner being of man. They are not there in the physical body. Please remember, these are relations of the nervous being with the psychological parts. That's all. It is not, when you say heart, it is not cardiac heart on the left side, but on the center. Psychic being is not in the heart, the cardiac heart which is on the left side. Psychic center is in the heart in the sense of, well, here, where it can influence the solar plexus. That's all. The solar plexus and the heart center are in communication or are possible to be in communication. All these centers are in the middle of the body. They are not connected with the physical functionings, you see. They are in the middle of the body. They are supposed to be attached to the spinal cord. But in fact, all these things are in the subtle body. Sukshma sharira, as it is called, in the subtle body. Sukshma deha. Though one has a feeling of their activities as if they are in the physical body when the consciousness is awake. Then they are, as it were, some movement takes place corresponding in the physical also at the same time. In the procedure of our yoga, the centers have each a fixed psychological use and general function which base all their special powers and functioning. The Muladhara means the end of the spinal cord governs the physical down to the subconscious. The abdominal center, Swadhisthana, governs the lower vital. The navel center or the Nabhi Manipur governs the larger vital. The heart center or Rit Padma governs the emotional being. The throat center governs the expressive and externalizing mind. The center between the eyebrows is Agna Chakra, governs the dynamic mind, will, vision and mental formation. The thousand-petal lotus Sahasradala above commands the higher thinking mind, houses the still higher illumined mind, and at the highest open the intuitive through which or else by which an overflooding directness and directness the overmind can have with the rest communication and immediate contact. The Sahasradala acts as a connecting or communicating link between the higher functioning, the above the mind and the lower, psychological functioning of the human being. Heart is a seat of two powers. In front, the higher vital or the emotional being. Behind, the soul or the psychic being. The heart has two functioning. One, surface movement and deeper movement. The surface movement is that of the higher vital being and emotional being, and behind is the soul of the psychic being, the true individuality of man. The colors of the lotuses in number and petals are respectively from bottom to top. The Muladhara or the physical consciousness has four petals which are red. The abdominal center has six petals, deep purple red. The navel center, 10 petals, violet. The heart center, 12 petals, golden pink. The throat center, 16 petals, gray. The forehead center, between the eyebrows, 2 petals, white. The thousand petal lotus above the heart, blue with gold light around. Well, this gives you roughly the idea of how it is organized in psychology, as we are likely to come across as we progress in the study of the yoga, you see. The functions are, according to the yoga, commanding of the physical consciousness and the subconscious, commanding of the small vital movements, greeds and lusts and desires and small sense movements. The navel center commands the larger vital forces and passions and larger desire movements. Then the heart commands the emotional being with the psychic deep within it. This throat center commands the expression and externalization of mind and movements of mental forces. This thought commands the thought, will and vision. And the Sahasradala command the higher thinking mind and illumined mind and opening towards the intuitive and the overmind. And that is how it is functioning. When we speak of Purusha in the heart, we are using a figure. The Muladhara from which a Kundalini, the sleeping energy arises, is not in the physical body but in the subtle body. You see, they say awakening of the sleeping power, serpent power as it is called. Well, it is not in the physical body, but in the subtle body. Well, the subtle body is that in which the being goes out in deep trance or more radically at the time of death. That is the subtle body, you see. So also are all the centers. But as the subtle body penetrates and is interfused with the gross body, there is a certain correspondence between these centers or chakras and certain centers in the physical proper. So figuratively we speak of the Purusha in this or that center of the body, but it is really in the subtle body. That I think we'll stop there for tonight, otherwise cannot cover any subject. There, I'll just read it out. It's a nice interesting passage, you see. As to doubts and argumentative answers to them, I have long given up the practice as I found it perfectly useless. Shyamdo's letter to somebody who says, why don't you answer doubts? Yoga is not a field for intellectual argument or discussion. It is not by exercise of logic and or debating mind that one can arrive at a true understanding of yoga or follow yoga. A doubting spirit, honest doubt, and the claim that intellect shall be satisfied and be made the judge on every point is all very well in the field of mental action outside. But yoga is not a mental field. And the consciousness which has to be established is not mental, logical or debating consciousness. It is even laid down by yoga that unless and until mind is stilled, including the intellectual mind and logical mind, and opens itself in quietude or silence to a higher and deeper consciousness, vision and knowledge, spiritual sadhana cannot reach its goal. For the same reason, an unquestioning openness to Guru is demanded in the Indian spiritual tradition. As for blame, criticism, and attack on the Guru, well, it was considered reprehensible and the surest possible way, an obstacle to sadhana. In the spirit of doubt, if the spirit of doubt could be overcome by meeting it with argument, there might be something in the demand for its removal by satisfaction through logic. But the spirit of doubt doubts for its own sake, for the sake of doubt. It simply uses the mind as an instrument for its particular dharma. And this not the least when the mind thinks it is seeking sincerely for solution of its honest and irrepressible doubts. Mental positions always differ. Moreover, it is well known that people can argue forever and ever without ever convincing each other. To go on perpetually answering persistent and always recurring doubts, such as for long have been filled in this ashram and obstructed sadhana, is merely to frustrate the aim of yoga and to go against the central principle with no spiritual or other gain whatever. If anybody gets over his fundamental doubts, it is by growth of psychic in him or by enlargement of his consciousness, not otherwise. Questions which arise from spirit of inquiry, not aggressive or self-assertive, but a part of hunger for knowledge, can be answered. But the spirit of doubt is insatiable and unappeasable. Yes, that is the letter. There is no clearer mind in the world.
Yet there's time, there's still time. In another sequence, another round.
Asana, standing on your head or twisting your body like that and doing something like this and so on. That's all that 9 out of 10 here in America has heard. That's all they've heard. So you simply sit down like that and something is done. Well, of course, something is done to your body, quite right. And you feel some acceleration, some strength and some quiet perhaps sometimes. That's all. That's not yoga. Yoga has to do with consciousness. You have to change inside. What's the use of all this twisting and torturing? That is the one thing. Japan, Hong Kong, everywhere, same. Everybody is sitting. There are organizational people in the morning between 6:30 and 7:30, 120 people in Hong Kong. They have an organization, all like this. All this building, and they all come down and all the time. I say it's a good exercise. Please be regular, I told. And don't overdo. Yes. Don't give up after 1 month. No, be regular and go on. Your body will be good. It's a very good thing. But don't think this is yoga. And I made them take a tape recorder so that they may not forget. They took a tape, you see, and I said, do it regularly, please come, don't miss a day and give it up and then you will have reaction. So better be regular and go on and be sure this is not yoga. This is for your body and nervous system, quite good thing, very good thing, but not yoga. And I gave the instance of 3 persons, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, Ramana Maharshi and Sri Aurobindo, all internationally well-known figures who never practiced one asana. So. Asana is not indispensable to yoga. But it's good. If it is comfortable, it gives you, gathers nervous energy. You know? Asana is one power, is to gather physical energy, nervous power. Quiets down your nerve, makes your nerve strong. Many advantages are there. I don't say it is bad, but it is wrong to think it is yoga. Certainly not. That is very positive. Yoga starts when you want to become different from what you are. Want to understand what you are, why you are, who you are, and what you are doing, why you are doing what you are doing, and then you find out, why am I here? Then you begin the yoga. Then you say, no, I want to reach a truth. And then, where are you now? If the truth is somewhere, where are you now? Although you say you are in a partial realm of truth and untruth. You see, that is called ignorance. So, in the mixture of truth and untruth, you try to walk out and eliminate untruth or ignorance and create a field of light in consciousness, you see. So that in consciousness you live in light. So what you do is a projection of the light. What you think is light, what you think is truth or, you know, acts. It is not simply what you do. No, from where you do. And that is a very important distinction. Yes, yes. It's a very great change is necessary in the mind of persons when they think about yoga here. But there are people who have some conceptions, and I think there is an aspiration there in good number. I don't say it is a negligibly small number, but in this case, it's not numbers that is important. It is real equality that is important. Even one man, when he does yoga, it is all right. That is the thing to be done. It doesn't matter if 100 people don't do yoga because they never intend. They come and listen and clap hand and say it is very nice and very good and go home and are quite happy afterwards and say it was good. All the boys with whom I talked to, they were talking. I told them about your God and so on. So they said, it was very good. I liked. I said, that is the least thing that I expect out of what I talked. I don't want that you should like what I say. You should do what I say. What's the use of saying I liked the talk was very nice. I enjoyed it. You enjoy cinema, all right. This is not a cinema. This is a serious business and I want you to attend to it. But in spite of them, something goes through. You see, even if they don't understand, you know, something goes through. And then it acts as a seed. You see, it doesn't work there and then. So I don't very strongly, you know, go against what they say. I liked it. And I say, well, now you like it, perhaps one day you'll follow it. I don't disappoint them. But when somebody claims that his liking is the end of the purpose, then I say, well, that is not what is wanted. Liking must be the beginning of doing. You must begin to do something. If there was no help, I can understand people thinking that I am alone, I can't do. But when there is such a powerful help like Mother and Shirmundo's, you know, guidance, then there is no difficulty. Why shouldn't you? If one wants, one can begin straight away. It doesn't require anything because you have a tremendous help. You see, the help is so strong and so great that many of the difficulties will be like that, you see. It is when the trains were not, you see, when the aeroplane was not, then the trains were there. Well, naturally, you took a lot of time. When the plane is there, you take few hours. The same thing like that. Only the aspiration must be genuine. That's all. Then you are taken quick, without you knowing it. Without you knowing it. You don't know what obstacles have been, you know, worked out in advance. Not that there will be no, for each one there will be sufficient weight to lift. Yes, quite enough to make him feel, oh, it's quite heavy. But it wouldn't be, you wouldn't have thought of it if somebody had not worked it out.